Thank you very much for having me this evening, and hi to all of you. I've only just got into the Discord thing, and I attended the last couple of meetings, the last one being this Wednesday just gone. And it became clear that a lot of the discussion that was going on then, linked in quite neatly with this evening. So I didn't make too many comments on Wednesday because I felt that I was going to be making those comments today. So thanks for, as I say, thank you for listening. So I began to look at, when I had a conversation with Adam, what would be good, if you like, to talk about. And one of the things that's always struck me since my first brush with socialism, which was really knowing my grandfather, who was a socialist, and later, of course, my mother, who you would remember, Marie Chesham. And I it always occurred to me that, or I always felt that there's so few of them. And this struck me as strange because, in a way, the reasons for being a socialist are so clear in my mind. So what I'm going to do is, I these slides are really more for me than anyone else, but it would help perhaps if we scrolled up through as we went. So I'm going to move up, and hope it sort of vaguely makes sense. I'm on slide number two now. I think what I'd like to happen, Brian just brought up the mentioned whether we discuss things during the presentation, if you like. And I think if we wait to the end, that would be great. And I think what I'm going to say is clearly personal, and it's my own personal opinions, and they may not necessarily, you may not all agree with them, but they are personal opinions, and they're thoughts for discussion. So I'm hoping that really a lot of what I will say, I've no doubt many of us will, many of you will concede on and agree with. But I'd like to really, if there's anyone online now who's listening to this, I think this is going to be aimed, if you like, to non-socialists from socialists. So I think what I'd like to be discussing is why there's so few of us, and perhaps introduce the idea of socialism to people that are not familiar with it, and really to help them, join the ranks, as it were, so there won't be so few of us. So I'm going to go on to slide three. So these are all sort of reasons, if you like, in my head, as to why I think socialism is not something that is adhered to by many people, and why socialists are so few in number. So firstly, socialism in the public mind. So if people hear of socialism, or they hear of socialists, what do they think of? Now, we all know that the word socialist means a lot of things, and I think it may have been Pat, or it may have been someone on Wednesday who mentioned this. So if we think of the National Socialist German Workers' Party, some people might think that they're socialists. The Labour Party is another one. I mean, almost everybody you talk to in the country would say, oh yes, Labour, socialist. And then you've got the great sort of, the huge dictatorships, Russia, China, and Chile, where Russia and China specifically, that have often cited as being communist or socialist, but of course we all know they're not, or weren't. And not only that, if you type in on Google, the Socialist Party, now you'd think you'd come up with us, but in fact I did it, and you don't. You come up with someone called the Socialist Party, but it's certainly not us. And it's a reformist group, because I looked into what they stood for. So I think this is a problem, and I think it might lead people not to join the party and not inquire in any depth about what we stand for and what we're thinking. And I think this is very important. So I had conversations with socialists on a number of occasions at head office and various other places, and the opinion amongst most of them, and I suspect we're probably all included in this, is, well, if they don't understand it, then it's their problem. Well, it is their problem, but it's also our problem, because if we're not encouraging people to buy into what we're thinking of, how we think and what we stand for, then we've got a problem because we are going to remain few in number. Okay, so I'm just going to go up to slide number four now. Now, this is the thing that really baffles me. And when one listens to the views of socialists and you look at the socialist ideals, it is so simple. And I tend to think of things in a simple way. And the other meeting we had, there was lots of talk about how erudite and clever and well-read and learned a lot of socialists are. And this is true, of course, it is true. But on the other hand, you can sweep aside the details sometimes. And in other words, what I mean by that is if you're talking to anyone, Joe Public, member of the family, friend or whatever, they will very quickly come up with all sorts of detail about what they've heard about something and why this doesn't work and so on and so forth. But in reality, it is so simple. If you sweep aside these details and look at the obvious thing that is happening in the world at the moment, you can ask yourself, is not the money and the profit-based system the root of almost every problem? And that, frankly, I would challenge anyone, and this is not socialist because I don't need to challenge them. They will always already be thinking along these lines. There's no point in giving out a challenge. This is for people I'm hoping that may be listening who are thinking, well, okay, what's this socialism stuff about? Well, okay, listen to the news. Listen to the media, listen to what's going on, the Radio 4, Today program, whoever it is, listen to those problems and ask yourself, what is the common denominator? What is always at the root of almost all of these problems? And the answer is really simple. It comes down simply to exchange of labor and money. And it's always the money's not there. This, you know, it's always that. And in actual fact, nothing on this planet we do requires the existence of our current system, the money profit system. Nothing. We can make furniture. We can grow food. We can discover new medicines. We can research. We can do all these things. Nothing we do needs money. So for me, in my funny mind, that is, it's so simple. It just is not that difficult to see. I have to say at this point, and, you know, this might, it may make some of you smile, I don't know, but some of my friends have often said they think I'm a bit on the spectrum, which I suppose by that it's a polite way of saying, you know, I get a bit obsessed by stuff. But what it also means is if they're correct, I do see things very simply, and I kind of am able to sweep this stuff aside and think, well, actually, it is really simple. We don't need this system. We just don't. So on almost everything, I think, I've mentioned the money, but, you know, a lot of things, I suppose some of you are thinking right now, well, okay, what about COVID? You know, that's not, caused by capitalism. Well, actually, have a read, if you get a chance, of, someone bought me a subscription to the Resurgence magazine. I have to say I'm not mad on it. It's all sort of, it tends to be a bit sort of wave your hands happily and crystals and we'll all live happily ever after, really. And I'm not keen on the magazine, but there was an article that I sent over to Adam not long ago by a chap, I think his name was Brendan Montague, where he really clearly explained why the COVID outbreak was directly the cause of capitalism. And so even that we're currently struggling with is a direct result of this system. Okay, I'm going to move on to slide. It's a bit pompous calling them slides, isn't it, really? They're just, you know, bits of writing. This is number five I'm looking at now. Okay, so left or right, the only way. This is another thing I think that people get bogged down in and perhaps, you know, why they don't really see what socialists are doing or what they stand for. If you think about it, all politics in general discussion, and I think we're probably, maybe we're guilty of this too, I don't know. But what I'm suggesting here is that if you align yourself with left or right politics, what you're actually doing is saying you've come up against a wall and the only way you can go is left or right. Or arguably, you've come up, and better analogy would be a T-junction in the road. You can only go, you've come to a T-junction, where do you go, left or you go right? Now, I think this is a problem, and I think it's a problem for socialism, because what we are actually offering, if you like, if people want to sort of join us, is not left or right. We're not left wing. What we're actually is heading forwards. We're changing everything. So we're not on a line that goes from the left to the right. We're beyond that line. And that's how we should all be thinking. Now, currently, our democratic system is like the choice that Henry Ford gave to his customers. And you may recall this famous saying, you can have any colour you want as long as it's black. Well, that is actually what our democratic system is saying to us, our so-called democratic system. And as far as black goes, it certainly is that. I mean, you know, there's very little hope at the moment in what's going on. And life is just not that bright, frankly. And so surely with all the proven and recurring problems that happen time and time again, the time for left and right is over. And I think now a new way forward is needed. But the thing to ask ourselves is it inevitable? And I think this is an important point. Is socialism an inevitable outcome of the collapse of capitalism? Because it will collapse. It may be apocalyptic and it may be dreadful, but it will go down because, you know, in a very, very short space of time, even in my lifetime, I've seen dreadful things happening, the decline of species, climate change. I was campaigning about the climate change thing back in 1999 and 2000, as some of you may know, very heavily involved with sort of environmental issues then. And nothing's changed. It's worse now than ever. So, you know, if the collapse of capitalism is inevitable, one question we might ask ourselves is socialism therefore likely to be the inevitable outcome of that? Okay. Slide number six, please. Right, the normality of capitalism. I've used these little key phrases so that really as prompts for myself, really, so that I can sort of remember what I was going to say. So at the moment, we live under a system in which the most appalling things are allowed to happen, and they continue to happen. Now, these things are taken by most, and this is a very convenient thing for world governments and indeed governments of individual countries. These things that are so awful are taken by people, most people, to be natural, inevitable, or as a result of human nature. Now, this is really odd, because what also links into this is charities. Now, our society in the Western world is often called civilized. Now, you could ask yourself, and I'm addressing this to a non-socialist, if our society is civilized, why do we need charities? Why do we need bodies of people that devote vast amounts of their own time, unpaid, to try and deal with all the ills of the world, whether it's starvation in Africa, whether it's I don't know, the decline of polar bears, the climate change, whatever it is. Why do we need that in a so-called civilized society? And is that normal? Is that part of the normality of capitalism? Now, just think for a second and ponder on these things. We live in a society that's got species decline, massive decline in species that we share the planet with, species that enrich our lives. These are things that are beautiful to look at. You know, they add to the environment. Some of them are essential for the environment. Bees, it would be an example of that. Essential for our own existence, I should say. Warfare. Now, you know, this is distant perhaps to some of us, but, you know, there are countries where people's children have had limbs blown off their bodies and they've had to watch them die. You know, that's how bad it is. That's going on all the time. We've got hunger and starvation. Now, they're not quite the same thing, because at the moment there are children in Britain that aren't starving, but they're very, very hungry. And look at the government versus the children's school meals thing. Crikey, they kicked up a fuss about that, didn't they? But, you know, buy some sort of fighter plane and they're up for it immediately. And they'll spend a vast, vast amount of money on so-called defence. So people, as well as being hungry, are starving in the world by dint of where they live, by dint of the fact they can't afford a bit of clean water, they starve to death. That's still going on. So look back, Bob Geldof, Feed the World. Did that help? It was massive news all over the world. No, it's still exactly the same. Homelessness. I was in Hereford yesterday or the day before, and there were people in sleeping bags lying in the subway with nowhere to go. That's in Hereford, so quite a nice little Cotswoldy kind. Well, it's not quite Cotswold, but it's a nice town. You know, people are lying there with nowhere to go. We've talked about climate change and we talked about COVID. These are all, when examined closely, a direct result of our current system. So the question is, why isn't everyone a socialist? Why do people fail to see this in any meaningful numbers? And later, I'm hoping that you'll be able to sort of comment on that. And one day, I'd quite like to, you know, deal with this in terms of a book or something and try and figure out why it is. And I mentioned psychiatrists at one of the last meetings and how interesting it would be to talk to a trained psychiatrist or, you know, why is it that people don't see what is staring them in the face? Can we go to number seven now, please? There's not many to go. I put here the only game in town. Now, this is an interesting one too, because society at large is force-fed a given. And that's done through by means of education. So curriculum for children, even at primary school age, involves an economic system. And they're taught that, even at primary school age. And advertising, peer pressure, news and the media, these are all devices that, if you like, force condition our brains, if you like, and make us think a certain way. And it takes a very special person to kind of see through all that. And as I think Paddy was saying, or someone was saying the other day, it's actually hard work. And it's quite, I think someone even used the word brave, you know, because you really are struggling, you know, you really are. And I put here access to knowledge and ideas. Now, I know there's lots of writing, and I know there's Socialist Party of Great Britain, and there's various things, but none of this is easily accessible, to be frank. If it was, we'd be given a spot-on thought for the day, you know, on Radio 4 in the mornings, and, one of us would be able to say, well, look, how about this? Instead of that, you get all this complete nonsense, you know, every morning, the same stuff, you know. Let's look at the crutch of this religion or that religion. That's what you get. You actually, access to proper knowledge is not that easy to come by. And if you don't delve into it and try and find it, you won't get there. You'll just be looking at a basic curriculum, your working life, and whatever it is that people want you to think. Now, this given, in other words, that the capitalism is the only game in town, this given includes such ideas as people are naturally selfish. That's a well-known one. And often when you talk about socialism to people, their first thing they will say is, oh, no, that won't happen because people are naturally selfish. They'll want more. Well, I would challenge that, obviously, because when there was the water shortage in 1976, this is a very simple and perhaps a simplified example, but I think it does illustrate the point. When there was that water shortage in 1976, they put standpipes in place. And what happened initially was people would rush there and queue up and fill up this, that and the other, every utensil they had. And they went home, they filled their baths up and all this stuff. But very, very quickly, that completely stopped, and people then just took what they needed. They didn't take more than they needed. So any idea that people are naturally selfish is nonsense. The other thing you get is wars will always be fought because they've always have been. And who would work if not for pay? And it's always been like this. And so you get these things that just trotted out time and time again. And they're just frankly not true. Now, some views, I think, I mentioned the media, some views that are left-wing, nowhere near as, in inverted commas, left-wing as we are, but they are tend to be associated also, if they're allowed onto the media at all, they're usually allowed through the conduit of a comedian or something. And some of you will remember Jeremy Hardy. And you know, in media terms and general terms, he would be considered quite left-wing. But interestingly, he was a comedian. So if people with views that are left of left, if you like, they kind of get tolerated, but they're put in the comedian slot, which straight away removes their gravitas. So I think there's another problem in terms of people's perception of left-wing views, let alone ours. I don't know how they would view ours in that respect. Okay, I'm going on to number 8. The Petri dish we live in. Now, right now, I have to be honest with you. There are times I wake up and I say to my wife, do you know what? I think I've been born at a time, unfortunately, as a member of a species that is about to wipe itself out. You know, if it doesn't do it with nuclear war or a virus or something, it'll do it just simply by destroying its own environment. I use the Petri dish analogy because it's rather like bacteria in a Petri dish. Once they've eaten all the agar jelly, that's it, they're finished. And kind of that's where we are. Now, we've got the big voices that we always have associated with our environment. Monbiot is one. I went to some Monbiot talks a while back. One was at the Hay Festival. And indeed, he's a friend of some friends of mine. And I did have an email conversation with him many years ago. But he has tended in the past to look at types of capitalism. So he's thought of sort of neoliberal capitalism or state capitalism or whatever term, form of capitalism it is. I suppose one thing that's slightly heartening, he's now saying that it's not the type of capitalism, but capitalism itself that needs changing. And I think that's sort of someone as famous as him that's saying it is hopeful. But that said, he still seems to go out, or he has been recently. I saw on the news with Extinction Rebellion, who will be familiar to all of you, I've no doubt. And so I know for a fact, having visited a number of Extinction Rebellion meetings, I went there on purpose really to try and see what they stood for, because obviously those of you that know me will know I'm sort of passionate about the environment and all the things that they seem to be passionate about themselves. But when I've spoken to them, they really do not seem to know what they want. They know what they're angry with, but they don't know what they want. They keep saying system change. But if you say to them, and I have said on 5 different occasions in 5 different cities at different meetings they've had, what system do you want? They kind of fall apart and they kind of, well, we don't want this one, but they don't know what they want. So I think that's also a problem, because I think why is it, therefore, that so many people who are as active as them, they're young, they're dynamic, there's lots of them, why aren't they socialists? Why are they not joining us? I don't know. On the environmental subject, one thing that I think is absolutely clear, and again, it comes down to my on-the-spectrum simple look at things, simplistic look at things. There's a documentary on the white rhino some time ago, which some of you may have seen. It may even be extinct now. Forgive me, I don't know. It was a year or two ago, but it was very close to extinction then. And what was happening with it is people were hunting it for its tusk, which apparently is some aphrodisiac in some parts of the world. So because they can sell this tusk, I say they being the poachers, for such a vast amount of money, and it is an obscene amount of money, they go to extraordinary lengths to kill this quite dangerous animal and cut off the tusk. So there was a documentary on that, and you know, this chap from, I know, the World Wildlife Fund or whoever it was, who'd worked with white rhino, he was almost in tears, because what they'd done is this is not the poachers, this is the biologists, the zoologists I should say. They darted a white rhino and they cut the tusk off themselves, because they thought if they did that, the poachers wouldn't then kill the rhino. But they did. The poachers killed it for the last centimetre of tusk, which shows how much that tusk was worth. But I would say to people, if we didn't live in a capitalist society, who on earth would travel miles into an inhospitable jungle with a dangerous rifle to confront a dangerous animal to cut its tusk off? No one. And another example is Spix's macaw, which is now extinct. Used to be vast, vast numbers of them not long ago, but because they were becoming more valuable, they kept getting shot, because the last one in existence was worth the most. So that basically is capitalism in a nutshell. And I'm just going to throw in a quick one because, in a way, forgive me if you think I'm a capitalist myself now, but in part of my life, I ran a small business. I was working with trees. I wasn't sort of a hedge fund manager or something, but I was working with trees, and that's what I did. I pruned trees for a living. But it occurred to me, even some many years ago when I was running that business, how utterly, utterly stupid and illogical it was. So what would happen was the actual, in simplistic term, and this probably applies to every single business, there was a battle, really. You had to try and win the work. Now, to win the work for your business as a tree surgeon, you perhaps would travel 30 miles to look at one apple tree that you could have pruned there and then, but the person you went to see would say something like, oh, I'm having five quotes for this because I want to get the cheapest quote. So you could take that five people from various companies gone to see one apple tree, used up a lot of fuel, and wasted vast amounts of time. Now, not only that, if you won that job, by definition, you would have been the cheapest. So something has to suffer when you give the cheapest quote for pre-surgery work. And it could be a rubber duck, it could be a loaf of bread, it could be a suite of furniture, anything you're selling on the market, this applies to. So people will buy it if it's the cheapest. Now, but the cheapest comes at a price. It means that the labor used to make that product or provide that surface, by definition, will be driven down. It will mean that they will not be interested in the work because they're under pressure to do it quickly. And the materials, by definition, will be cheaper because they will be sourced cheaper. So the quality will be down. I won't dwell on that because it's so obvious. But again, this is a symptom of capitalism. And perhaps people that might be socialists it'd be doing well to think about that, because we wouldn't get all the crap, basically. Everything would be made well and with care of the environment and indeed the people that make it. Okay, I'm just going to go into number nine now. Okay, so we've all done this. We talk to friends, we talk to people sometimes at talks, and I think we should be talking to more people and we should be spreading the word without wanting to sound too evangelical here. But you know as well as I do, you've talked to many people, including good friends, about true socialism. And more often than not, if they don't accuse you of, you know, living in some utopian fantasy world, after a while, and I've experienced this, I'd be interested to know whether any of you have, after a while, they become almost aggressive in their defence of a system that, even by their own admission, is dangerous and declining. Now, Carla organised a meeting in London a while back, and I was one of the speakers there, and there's another speaker whose name escapes me, but he wrote a book. I can't remember what it's called now either, my age, I'm afraid. But in it, he quoted an American, I think it was a psychologist, but he was saying in this book that most people find it easier to conceive of an entire collapse of society in a dystopian Mad Max way than they do of change. Again, this is a very worrying thing for socialists, because why is that? Why is it that people don't want to live in a world that, you know, is a caring world, a sharing world, and all the things we know it is or know it would be, but they can easily conceive of Armageddon? They can't conceive of change. I find this really astonishing, and I really don't know the answer. There are reasons that are said that people don't like change, and the three reasons given for reluctance to change are, firstly, is a lack of or perceived lack of reward. The second one is fear of the unknown. And thirdly, loss of status or visibility in the organisation. Now, we can probably expand on that a bit, because, you know, in a socialist society, the reward wouldn't be financial, so there'd be no money. But look at the benefits of the reward you would get. You'd have self-esteem. Now, self-esteem is unbelievably lacking at the moment, absolutely hugely lacking. Even if you go back 200 years, you had more self-esteem than people have now, despite the so-called progress. So if you were a blacksmith 200 years ago, it would be a good feeling having a piece of material and taking it from start to a finished product. And, you know, the same would apply to any craft of that time. Now, that doesn't happen now. More often than not, things are made by machine or, you know, even farming, you know, it's no longer the same as it was. You know, you don't physically cut the hay anymore. You're sitting in a tractor, air-conditioned tractor, you know, having just sprayed the fields with chemicals and listening to Radio 1 or something, whatever it is. So there's no self-esteem in work. And even in the workplace, you're beholden to a boss who often is a kind of a mini Hitler and you know, enjoys this little tiny bit of power they have in their lives and so on. So I think the lack of reward, I think the reward in socialism would come from many, many other sources. It wouldn't be money. Now, fear of the unknown, of course, this is an interesting one because people seem to cling to what they know and what they like. And loss of status or visibility in the organization. Well, of course, you wouldn't have status in the way that we've got now. I mean, these young children at the moment are desperate to be seen. So they're kind of constantly on YouTube or constantly photographing themselves. And I don't know what that says about society, but what it says to me is actually they're invisible and that's why they're doing it. In a socialist society, everybody will be valued. Everyone will feel good about being part of the society because it will be going somewhere. It wouldn't be destroying itself. The power that I'm just going to go on slide number 10. I noticed everyone's mic's off. I can't hear the yawning, which is good. Right, the power of the system. Now, this is a thing I think, I don't know if you agree with me, but I really believe that we need to get clear on this, and that is that capitalism is not a person. A capitalist is a person, but capitalism is not. Neither is it a group of people. It's merely a means of organizing society. So, despite the fact that it is clearly failing the majority of people in the world, and arguably the capitalists themselves, and I say that, it continues to exist despite that, but I say the capitalists themselves because, and this baffles me, at the moment we are losing things, you know, that are beautiful. HS2, you're probably familiar with, has destroyed ancient woodlands, destroyed the habitats of butterflies, lichens, and so on and so forth. And the trees themselves, and they can't be replaced by little trees in little tubes. And believe me, I know that because I was a tree surgeon and a tree consultant. They will not be able to replace those ancient woodlands. But that has been done to shave a few minutes off a journey to Birmingham and to employ, keep people employed. Despite all this failing, it continues to exist, the society as it is. Now, it could be changed at a stroke by a simple change of mindset. Now, this is the thing that, again, why is it that people aren't having that mental change? And it needs to be the realization that there is another way. It doesn't have to be like this. And more importantly is the knowledge of what goes in its place. And this is why I think Extinction Rebellion are failing, because, you know, with all the best will in the world and the lovely people that are members of Extinction Rebellion, in my view, they don't and have not demonstrated what they want to put in its place. They're just angry with what there is. Incidentally, in terms of societal change, a lot of people say, oh, God, you know, that'll evolve. It'll take years. This is nonsense. I have a friend, a lady called Kathleen Wickham-Jones, who lives up on Orkney, and she wrote a book called Fear of Farming. And there was a very, very interesting bit in that book where she talked about, she's an archaeologist, by the way, she talked about the change from Paleolithic civilization to Neolithic civilization. Now, in your head, you probably think, oh, maybe that took thousands and thousands of years. It didn't. It took a couple of generations. The moment people started sort of farming the land, it happened really quickly. And so what I'm saying is that whoever tells you that socialism it may happen sometime in the future, it could happen within a year, easily. Okay. Before I leave slide 10, I just wanted to say the one thing that is really not in our favour and why there's so few socialists is capitalism has an undeniable strength and an ability to sustain itself, even when the continued safe existence of humanity itself is in doubt. Now, this is something that I've noticed. It's incredibly powerful as a system, and it's powerful in the way that it it almost self-perpetuates itself. It's just astonishing. It's like a cell, a cancer that keeps dividing, because its system, its means of working, convinces people that it is the only game in town. Okay, slide 11. You'll notice we're nearly at the end. Those of you who have been impatiently scrolling up. Okay, normality before the virus. Now, consider for a moment how the government have dealt with this pandemic, where we are now. It's been a constant battle between saving the economy and the lives of people. And I think that says it all. You know, it's always on the news, and we all know how the scientists were saying, I don't think this is a good idea. And, you know, the politicians squirm around it and lie, blatantly lie, and ignore them, and then do what they want. And they, of course, are tools of capitalism. So people, as a result, have died. Now, should we be sad? Should we be surprised? Well, not really, because this is also a system that happily sends people to be blown apart in wars. So why would it be too bothered about a few old people in old people's homes? And not only that, they've done their stint. They're not actually terribly useful anyway. I know that sounds an incredibly callous thing to say, but actually, I believe it to be true. I should also say, coming back to the power of capitalism, I'm just going to sort of, I'm not going back a slide, but a point that relates to the last slide. My own daughter, she's 30. She trains as an illustrator, but as an illustrator, she can't find work. Well, said she can't. She probably could, but she's got to survive. So it's not easy when you're an artist, and I know that myself. So she works in a care home, and that's down in Kent. And she often, when I ring her, she tells me stories about what it's like to work in a care home. And we've all heard the stuff on the news, but she's got a couple of friends who are quite political and very, very unhappy with their circumstances, and probably would be the sorts of people that would want change and would be willing to make change. But when I talked to her, I even mentioned the Socialist Party to her, she said they can barely survive from week to week. They get their check in, their wage check, which is minimum wage, and that immediately pays off a bit of their overdraft. And then the whole thing happens all over again. And it's a hellishly hard life. And I know that from now having spoken to her in some detail. But that's an ordinary working life. That hundreds upon millions of people are in that position where they barely get to the next week and waiting for their paycheck and watching every penny. That's the normality of capitalism. And that's why it's so powerful. It doesn't actually allow people time to consider an alternative, which is another reason there are so few socialists. Still on slide 11, the speed in which people without government help, and this is relating to the virus really, managed to organise themselves locally in a wider sense, showed that change could happen, and it could happen fast. But that was quite interesting, because what the media, you know, being the voice of the government, this getting back to normal phrase, you will all know, was, you know, bandied around all the time. And it was really clever, actually, because it was once again one of these little subtle things that capitalism does, you know, that, you know, let's get back to normal. So you think that what went before was normal, when in reality it was far, far from a normal existence for most people. Well, it might be, you know, routine for them, but it's not a good existence. So I think you get what I'm saying there. And the idea that there's another way and people might be thinking for themselves began to look perilously close. So I think that's why they ramped up the let's get back to normal thing. Anyway, so thank you very much for listening to that. And for the minute, that's all I have to say on that. And I hope it's prompted some thoughts. But what before I just before I finish, I would say that I know from experience when I've talked before at head office and other venues, it is always very, very disheartening on two counts. One, there are often so few people you're talking to, and the second thing is they nearly all agree with you because we're not reaching people that aren't socialists, sadly, or not to the degree I'd want to think we it would be nice. I'm not blaming us, really. I'm just saying, you know, this is the point of this talk, really. What do we need to do to find more? Okay, thank you.